From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff. The journey that we're about to embark on is a complicated one. At least one element of the case is complicated. And that's the crime itself, or the crimes themselves would be a more appropriate way to put it. We're going to be dealing with five murders spread across two completely different crime scenes located about a mile apart. Three people were murdered inside of a house, and two unrelated victims were found murdered in a baseball field across town. At one scene, the three victims were all shot in their living room, fully clothed, almost ambushed with elements of the scene that might make you think of a mob hit, a series of executions. On the other scene, the bodies of the victims were found outside in the snow, one nude and another one partially dressed, with bloody drag marks indicating that the bodies had been moved. At first glance, one might assume that these two incidents are unrelated. Two random acts of violence, especially in a city like Gary, Indiana, where the homicide rate ranks 10 times higher than the national average. But a closer look reveals that there are similarities, elements of forensics and MO that connect the two scenes. Besides the fact that the murders all occurred on the same night, February 16th into the 17th of the year 2000, all five victims were shot in the head with a 38 caliber pistol. The not-so-complicated part of the story is the wrongful conviction of a man named Chris Bynum. 25 years ago, the case seemed simple to Chris's jury. He had signed a confession to start with. Two, in fact. One that clearly reflects the investigator's initial theory on the case, and then a second that parroted a revised theory once the first narrative was disproven. The second narrative doesn't align with the evidence either, and unfortunately for the investigators, Chris wouldn't be coerced into a third statement, so the prosecutor would be forced to go to trial with a written confession that had no real basis in reality. Sadly, as all of you are well aware, details don't generally matter to real-life juries, because no one would ever confess to a crime that they didn't commit. Right?
So what they'll do is they'll try to convince you that, first of all, everything you think you know to be true is wrong. So there's this, first of all, this element of like gaslighting, like they lie to you, they give you false information that then sort of in the pressure cooker of the interrogation causes you to question your own understanding of reality, like your own, like what was communicated to me, for instance, is that everything I thought I remembered about the night that the murder happened, that I was staying the night at my boyfriend's house, that we were watching a movie, that we had dinner. Like I had all of these very vivid memories of what I was actually doing that night. And they told me that they had 100% proof that that was wrong, that they had physical proof that showed that I was at my house, not at my boyfriend's house, the night that the crime occurred. And that what that meant was that my mind, like I had must have witnessed something so horrible that my mind not just blacked it out, but made up memories to cover up for the horrific thing that I must have experienced. So now they're lying to me. They're introducing a new reality to me, but they are also justifying that new reality with an explanation that I can maybe sort of get behind. Like, oh, I've never, like, yes, I'm now in a traumatic situation. Like my roommate's just been murdered. They call this, in psychological terms, the cognitive opening, right? Like, and you actually see this in when people study extremism and how people are turned from regular everyday people into terrorists, is they say very often they target people who have just experienced something very traumatic. So like someone close to them dying, like that experience makes someone feel a little bit unsteady with the world. Like they're just going about their day and all of a sudden someone close to them dies. At that moment in their life, they are psychologically experiencing what is called a cognitive opening, when the world as they knew it is under question. And so now in that pressure cooker of an interrogation room where I've already been cognitively opened by the fact that my roommate just was suddenly murdered for no reason, I'm given this new information that makes me question my own reality, makes me question my own sanity, and then introduces new information that I want to grasp onto because I'm motivated to grasp onto because here are these authority figures that I am now relying on for my own safety. Like, you know, there's a murderer on the loose and I'm scared. I don't know what to do. I'm calling police officers for help. I was the one who called the police for help. I reach out to them and I'm leaning on them. And in response, they are giving me certain kinds of behavioral cues about what they are looking from me. So when I say I was at my boyfriend's house, they get mad at me. They yell at me. They hit me. When they suggest to me, oh, you were at the house and you witnessed something terrible and you don't remember it. And I say, well, maybe that's true. Suddenly I'm given a lot of like support and like handholding and it's going to be okay. And you just need to remember the truth. Try to remember the truth. So there's a lot of like psychological game playing here where on the one hand, they're beating you with the stick. On the other hand, they're, you know, holding out the carrot, which is this new reality that they are suggesting to you. And the minimization then comes in where they say, you didn't, you know, they're not accusing you of committing the crime. They're accusing you of having witnessed it, of having been present, which of course implicates yourself in the crime.
That was Amanda Knox talking a little bit about how false confessions happen. But in Chris's case, just like in Amanda's, even if the jury was skeptical about the inaccurate confession, that didn't really matter. Because in Chris's case, the state had a witness. A star witness who clearly identified Chris as the killer in front of the jury. Like I said, for the jury, this was a simple and obvious case of guilt. And now, 25 years later, the case is even more simple. But everything that seemed clear at trial has now been flipped on its head. This is now a simple case of actual innocence. The confessions were never reliable. The star witness has recanted, admitted that he lied, and explained how he was coerced by the police to change his story. All forensic testing, and there's been a lot, excludes Chris Bynum as the murderer. New suspects have been identified, and there's even been another confession to the quintuple homicide. There is no doubt about it, Chris Bynum is an innocent man, and yet 25 years later, he remains in prison for these crimes that he did not commit. Our goal is to change that, to free Chris Bynum and once and for all provide justice for Sheila Barty, Liz Ayers, Suzanne Wallace, Angela Wallace, and Anthony Jeffers. Welcome to Season 17 of Truth and Justice. With a complicated case like this one, it's difficult to know where to begin. It's even difficult to know how to tell you the story. The reason is because the story, as we understand it, is largely derived from witness statements. The situation gets extremely complicated when the witnesses change their stories multiple times throughout the years. Larry Brooks is a perfect example. He was the state's star witness at trial. He told one story in his initial interview, a different story in subsequent interviews, and a completely different story at trial. And then years later, admitted that none of those stories were true. So, which version do we use to lay out the foundation for this season? Erica and I talked a lot about this. For those of you who are new to the season, Erica is our main researcher and producer. She does most of the behind-the-scenes things that help make these episodes come together. Ultimately, this is the plan that we came up with. we have to pick a moment in time, a version of the story to begin with as our baseline. So we decided to go with the details from trial. I'm going to walk you through the events of February 16th into the 17th in chronological order based on the police reports and what the witnesses testified to at trial. This will be our starting point. As the season moves along, we'll break down every element piece by piece, and hopefully together, we can figure out what really happened on that horrible night. We're going to start with a woman named Michelle Flores. She's not a victim, but was the last person to see Sheila Barty, who she calls Renee, and Liz Ayers alive that night. To avoid future confusion, I will always refer to Sheila by her actual first name, Sheila. Even when she's referred to as Renee in the trial transcripts, I'm still going to read it as Sheila. Trust me, this case does not need any extra confusion. So here we go. Michelle lived in the Duneland Trailer Park in Gary, Indiana. She testified that on the day of the murder, she popped in at her neighbor Sheila's house and asked her to come back over to her place to hang out. Sheila obliged, and according to Michelle, she spent most of the day and night at her house. Michelle says that around 11 p.m., she was in bed sleeping, and Sheila was asleep on one of her couches, when another friend of hers named Liz Ayers knocked on her door and asked to use her phone. Michelle let her in, allowed her to use the phone, and ultimately told her that she could just stay the night at her place. Sheila was still asleep on one couch, so Michelle offered up the other for Liz. Liz used the phone, and Michelle retired back to her bedroom. But about 20 minutes later, her phone started ringing. I'll read you right from the transcript. Quote, "I called from the bedroom, and I said, 'Did you page somebody? Because no one would be calling me at this time.' She said, 'Yes.' Question, rather than what she said, what happened then? She answered the telephone." End quote. After taking the call, Liz asked Michelle to go to the liquor store with her. She declined since she'd already been to bed, so Liz asked Sheila to go with her instead. And this is one of those moments that just absolutely breaks your heart when you really think too much about it. See, Sheila didn't know Liz. They weren't friends. They both had Michelle in common, but that appears to be their only connection. From the transcript, question, "After she used the telephone, did she stay with you or did she leave? What was her actions?" "She asked me to go to the liquor store with her, and I told her no, I was already in bed." "Did she stay in the house or did she leave?" "She left for the liquor store." "Did she leave alone?" "No." "Who did she leave with?" "Sheila left with her." "Were these two friends or did they know each other, to your knowledge?" "No, they weren't friends. They might have met each other at my house, I'm not sure, but no, they weren't friends. Sheila was my neighbor." End quote. Sheila leaving to go out with a woman that she didn't really know after she had already been asleep for the night ultimately ended up costing her her life. Now at this point, it's sometime around midnight at Michelle's house when Sheila and Liz took off for the liquor store and Michelle went back to bed. Michelle had given them her house keys so that they could get back in when they returned without waking her up. But at 1 a.m., Michelle did wake up. She went into the living room and realized that her friends hadn't returned. This next exchange from trial raises a couple of red flags regarding credibility, but we'll dig into that later. Just know this for now. The note that you're about to hear Michelle describe was never found, collected as evidence, or even ever existed as far as anyone knows for sure. From the transcript, quote, "Michelle, I woke back up about 1 and they weren't back, so I went out to the living room to see if maybe I didn't hear them come in, and I saw a phone number laying by the telephone, and I pushed *69 to find out the number that had called back." Question, "You mentioned that there was a piece of paper by the phone?" "Yeah, and what was on the paper?" The defense lawyer objects as hearsay, it's noted. Then Michelle responds, "A phone number and the name Chris." End quote. Now again, this is part of the simple case presented to the jury. Liz had wrote a note with the name Chris on it and a phone number right before she left the house and was killed. But I'm sure you're asking yourself the same question that I'm asking. What was the number on the paper? Where is the paper? And if there was a note with a phone number, why didn't Michelle try calling that number instead of hitting star 69? All questions we're going to dig into later. Hey everybody, Bob here. I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work, and I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads. That same night, just under a mile away from Michelle's house, a 12-year-old boy named Larry Brooks was home at 4412 East 10th Avenue with his mother, Suzanne Wallace, his aunt, Angela Wallace, who coincidentally was also known by her friends as Renee, and Angela's boyfriend, Anthony Jeffers, who was affectionately known as Amp, as well as Anthony and Angela's one-year-old baby, Katrina. Now again, in order to avoid confusion, I'm always going to refer to Angela as Angela, not Renee. Just like with Sheila, when somebody refers to her as Renee in the transcript, I'm going to read it as Angela. Five victims is difficult enough to keep track of without two Renees. So on February 16th, 2000, this was a Wednesday, Larry was walking home from school when his Aunt Angela saw him and stopped to give him a ride home. As far as Larry describes it at trial, it was a normal evening. Anthony and one-year-old Katrina were at the house when he and Angela arrived, and his mother Suzanne arrived home at around 8 or 8:30. At about 9 p.m., 12-year-old Larry went to bed. His mother, aunt, Anthony, and Katrina were all out in the living room of the small home. But sometime later that night, Larry was awakened by arguing. Remember, this isn't Larry's final story. It's just the story that he told at trial. From the transcript, quote, "I was woke up with arguing by arguing. And tell me about this arguing. Could you tell who was arguing or what did you do? Well, I had woke up and I heard the arguing and then I just got scared and sitting on my bed." "Why were you scared?" "Because I didn't know what was going to happen." Could you hear the voices?" "Yes." "Who were the voices that you could hear?" "Anthony Jeffers and my mom and Angela was screaming." "Angela was screaming? Could you hear anybody else in the house?" "Yes." "Who else did you hear?" "Chris Bynum," end quote. Larry testified that the arguing went on for about 15 or 20 minutes. He said that he actually fell asleep before the argument ended. He assumed that his family resumed to their normal activities after the two men left the house. Now here's where we start to see some plot holes in Larry's testimony. First, he said this, quote, "After this argument was over, what happened?" "Well, how did it end? Do you know?" "No, I had went to sleep." Okay, did you know, did anybody leave the house or did they stay in the house?" "Well, I went to sleep. I guess they left," end quote. So he doesn't really know what happened after this argument. He was sleeping. In fact, he was sleeping before the argument ended. But later, he's asked for details about what was going on in the house after the men left, and he says this. "Well, my mother was doing her puzzle book, and Angela was watching TV." "And what did Anthony do?" "He was in the room." "What room was he in?" "My mother's room." "What did he do?" "Probably watching TV." "Not guessing, but do you know what he did?" "Well, I know he called Willie on the phone." "Okay, now who is Willie?" "Anthony's brother." "How do you know he called him on the phone?" "Because he said his name on the phone," end quote. So somehow Larry's asleep in his bedroom, which is down the hall from the living room, but he also knows that his mother was doing a puzzle book and Angela was watching TV. He also listened in on Anthony talking on the phone with his brother Willie, all while he's asleep down the hall and the TV was on. Larry told the jury that he figures the call happened about 20 minutes after the men left the house, and it lasted for around 5 to 6 minutes. But at this point in his testimony, now Larry says that he didn't go to sleep until after the call ended. Anthony's brother Willie also testified and said that he received a call from Anthony at around 1 or 1:20 a.m., and of course the state didn't obtain any phone records to confirm this, they just took Willie's word for it. According to Larry's time estimate, at around 1 a.m., all hell broke loose. He was awakened by loud banging noises coming from the living room. Gunshots. 12-year-old Larry is very specific about the shots. He heard one shot, a pause, then two shots, another pause, then two more shots. And here's Larry explaining what else he heard during the shooting, and keep in mind, because you'll never guess this, Larry doesn't know Chris Bynum. He's never met him, never seen him before, and yet still at trial, he says this, quote, "While this is going on, did you hear any voices in the house?" "Yes." "What voices did you hear?" "I heard Chris Bynum say something about putting another shell in." "Did you hear, besides Chris Bynum, was it the same Chris that you talked about that was at the house before?" "Yes." Did anybody answer him? Did you hear the voice of another person?" "Yes." "Did you know who that person was?" "No, I did not." "Was it a man's voice or a woman's voice?" "It was a man's voice," end quote. Larry goes on to say that the two men then turned off the lights and left the house. He went out into the living room and found his family had been murdered. Angela and Anthony were covered in blood and motionless on the floor. And Suzanne, his mother, was also motionless but was still breathing. The only survivor in the living room was 1-year-old Katrina, who was laying on the couch, covered in blood and screaming. This next piece will be important later as we try to build a realistic timeline. Sometime between 1:20 and 1:40 a.m., a woman named Jean Eggleston reported hearing gunshots, not from Larry's house, but from a baseball park about a mile away. Now, it's important to keep those times in mind much later as we move along, because I'll tell you this much now. The state's theory is that the murders at Larry's house happened first before the second set of murders. But again, here, Miss Eggleston heard the shots near the ballpark between 1:20 and 1:40 a.m., which is about the time that Anthony's brother Willie says that he was on the phone with Anthony. Now back to our timeline at Larry's house, Larry gave an estimate of about when he thought the murders happened and when he called police, but he appears to be off based on the dispatch log, so I'm not going to confuse you with those times. He said that he called 911 right after finding his family in the living room. But Officer Jeff Trevino was the first to arrive at the scene at 2:38 a.m. He testified that his response time was under a minute. So we can assume that the attack at Larry's house happened at around 2:30 a.m. on the 17th, And again, we have that report of gunshots near the baseball field across town at 1:30 a.m., about an hour earlier. We have a rough timeline at this point that I want to review before we move on. So at around 9 p.m., Larry went to bed at what we'll call crime scene number one. At around 11 p.m. at Michelle's house across town, Liz showed up and asked to use Michelle's phone. At around 11:30 p.m., someone called that house, evidently returning a page that Liz had sent. At around midnight, Liz and Sheila left Michelle's house to go to a liquor store. Sometime between 9 p.m. and 1 a.m., according to Larry, two men went to crime scene number one and argued with Anthony, Angela, and Suzanne. Then, according to Willie, Anthony's brother, Anthony called him from crime scene number one at around 1 a.m. At about that same time, around 1 a.m. across town, Michelle wakes up and realizes that Sheila and Liz hadn't returned from their liquor store trip. So she starts calling around to some of Liz's friends to see if anyone knows where she is. At around 1:30 a.m., we have a report of gunshots coming from the area of the baseball field, which we'll call crime scene number two. At around 2:30 a.m., an hour later, according to Larry, two men entered the crime scene number one again and shot and killed Suzanne, Angela, and Anthony. The rest of that night was spent with the Gary Police Department investigating the triple homicide at Larry's house, crime scene number one. Even in a city with a high murder rate like Gary, investigating a triple homicide is a difficult task. And later in the afternoon on the 17th, things got even worse. All of this happened on a Wednesday night into Thursday morning. Once the sun came up on Thursday, Michelle started to get really concerned. Not only was she worried about Sheila and Liz, but they also had her keys. Remember, she had given them the keys so they could get back into the house when they returned from the liquor store. But her car keys were on that same ring, so Michelle was effectively stranded. After calling everyone she could think of to try to locate her friends, Michelle eventually called the police that morning. She asked them if she needed to be related to someone to report them missing, and the police basically blew her off and told her just to give it some time, which, to be fair, makes sense, because not only are we talking about two adults that don't live with Michelle, but the department was already also very busy at this point dealing with a triple homicide. But then, around 1:30 p.m., a man named Terrell Triggs Sr. was out walking his dog around the baseball park located at 14th and Idaho Street. It was your typical gloomy northern Indiana winter day. Some snow on the ground, some muddy areas where the snow had melted, and gloomy gray skies. Here's Terrell from trial sharing what he discovered. Quote, "I was walking the dog around the field, and we got to the east side of the field. There was a car on the other side of the fence, and my dog started barking, and we went through the gate. And once I got to the gate, I walked close to the car, and I looked down. It's a road that goes along there, and there was a trail of blood going along that trail, and there was a trail of blood going back up into some bushes." End quote. Terrell tied up his dog to a fence and followed the trail just far enough to see that the blood trail led to what looked like a dead body in the bushes. He quickly retreated, untied his dog, and went back the way he came. He called the police at 1:59 p.m., and Officer John Kouros was dispatched to the scene. Kouros and a Corporal Galinas were first to approach the scene. They first checked out the car to confirm that no one was inside. The officers then followed the blood trail back to the bushes. The blood trail in the snow appears to be a drag mark. It's not a dripping blood trail. There's a picture of it on our website, and it's also the background image for this season's logo. It's pretty clear that at least one of the victims was deceased or at least bloody and unconscious before they were moved to their final resting place. Like I said, we'll be digging deep into the details of this crime scene in another episode. Today, you're just getting the 30,000-foot view. As the officers followed the blood trail, they came across a horrific scene. From the detective's report, quote, It was discovered that indeed two females were dead. One female was partially nude and the other female was totally nude with only her pants down at her ankles. At that time, both were considered as Doe Jane number 1 and Doe Jane number 2. End quote. One of the victims, the one who was partially clothed, had drag marks on her back. Both had been shot. The scene is disgusting. Any murder scene is, but this one is particularly awful. The victims were discarded like pieces of trash, like they weren't even human, dragged and tossed into the bushes with zero regard for their humanity. The victims were eventually identified as Sheila Barty and Elizabeth Ayers. Michelle Flores had called back into the police station in the evening on the 17th. She still hadn't heard from her friends and was getting very concerned. She described some of Sheila's tattoos to a detective who then went to the morgue and confirmed that Sheila was in fact one of the victims. The next day, Michelle and Sheila's sister Donna went to the station and officially identified Liz and Sheila as the two dead bodies from the baseball park. Two crime scenes, five murder victims, and two very different sets of circumstances. At crime scene number one, according to the only witness, there was a clear personal connection between the victims and the offenders. Two men came to the house and argued with the victims, then left, came back later, and executed everyone in the living room besides the baby on the couch, and Larry, unbeknownst to the offenders, who was in the back bedroom. 36-year-old Anthony Jeffers, 35-year-old Suzanne Wallace, 24-year-old Angela Wallace were all shot multiple times. Then the killers simply shut off the lights, closed the door, and fled the scene. Across town, but around the same time of night, 37-year-old Sheila Barty and Liz Ayers, who had never met each other that we know of before that night, left their friend's house to go to a liquor store and ended up nude, partially clothed, shot to death, and dragged into a pile of bushes in a public park. Two very different crimes in two very different locations. One was clearly a targeted attack, three people ambushed in their own home, whereas the other appears to be completely random. Two women who didn't know each other, who very well could have been asleep on couches that night instead of venturing out to a liquor store, killed and discarded at a ballpark. Nothing about these two murders appears to be related, other than the fact that the same caliber of gun was used at both scenes. But a .38 caliber is far from rare. It's a relatively common round. Now, in some smaller, safer communities, it would be easy to make the connection. But in the year 2000, Gary, Indiana's population was roughly 100,000 people and steadily declining. Citizens were facing economic hardships due to the decline of the steel industry, which was once the city's backbone, along with high rates of poverty and crime. Violent crime was a significant issue, especially homicides. In 1994, just 6 years before these murders occurred, Gary was declared the murder capital of the United States, and things weren't much better in 2000. The year of these murders, Gary's murder rate was 53 out of every 100,000 people. That was nearly 10 times the national average of 5.5. And to put that in perspective, Gary's homicide rate of 53 was higher than Chicago, which was 20, and even Detroit, which was 46. The point being, two murder scenes in a single night was anything but an automatic connection in Gary, Indiana. But it was Detective Lewis Donald who first suggested that the two scenes could be intertwined. From his trial testimony, quote, "After that, we proceeded back to the station and I expressed my concern to Detective Gault in reference to these homicides and three other homicides earlier that morning. I told him, I believe that they were related and I bet we're going to find a connection to the two." End quote. That connection was the caliber of the gun used in the fact that all five victims were shot in the head at close range. And within 24 hours, the Gary Police Department went from two crime scenes, five victims, a spree killing, to a suspect, a confession, and an arrest. Less than 24 hours of investigating, and as far as the detectives were concerned, Chris Bynum was their guy. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music is created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kay Wood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.